I guess we'll start. Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. My name is Andrew Marganat. I'm a PhD student at UC Davis with Louise Jackson and Sanjay Parikh. And today I'd like to talk to you a little bit about some work that I've been doing with the International Center for Tropical Agriculture, CIAT, located in Kenya. And specifically, I'll be talking about one of two long-term trials that we have out in West Kenya that are looking at phosphorus fertility management. So a bit of background. Phosphorus deficiency is a major constraint to ag productivity in this part of the world. This is largely due to the acidic and weathered nature of the soils in this region. They're mostly taxing out as ultrasols and oxisols. So farmers can deal with this by adding phosphorus as inputs. And P inputs in this region are largely of two types. Triple superphosphate, which has about twice the phosphorus and in a more soluble form than rock phosphate, from which it is made. In this region, the main source of rock P, both for the input of rock P and for making TSP, is Minjungo rock phosphate, coming from northern Tanzania. So previous studies have shown that fertilization with either rock P or TSP will lead to differences in soil test phosphorus. So these are very labile phosphorus pools, Bray, Olson, and Mellick, and that there's potential differences in test phosphorus over the course of one or two growing seasons. But less is known about the effect of these two different inputs on long-term long-term amendment, and furthermore, on not just these very labile fractions like Bray or Olson, but more slowly cycling phosphorus fractions that could become crop available over longer periods of time. So our research team was thus motivated to look at two main questions. First, how does P input in the form of TSP versus rock phosphate over the longer term, and by this we have in mind over a decade, how do they affect soil phosphorus fertility? And by fertility, we have in mind two different measures. First, soil phosphorus saturation, so how much can the soil retain phosphorus? And second, phosphorus fractions, ranging from labile to not so labile to fixed or unavailable P. Second question, how do these parameters of soil fertility respond to liming? Liming has been used in very similar soil conditions to alleviate phosphorus deficiency. Most notable is the story of the liming in the Brazilian Cerrado with oxisols there. And currently there's investigation looking at potential liming rates for this part of the world in western Kenya. So to test this, we looked at one of two long-term trials located in western Kenya on this map. You can see that it's by the shores of Lake Victoria near the major city of Kisumu. This site is located on a soil type representative of the landscape. It's a classical oxisol, meaning it's acidic, has a high clay content, and this clay fraction is mostly kaolinite and, as you can see by the color, iron oxides, which can fix phosphorus. So we sampled in the 11th year at three depths and for three treatments, which were P inputs either as TSP or MRP, each to the tune of 50 kilos per hectare per year, as well as a unfertilized but still cultivated control. So, not surprisingly, after 11 years, we saw that there was an increase in total soil phosphorus for the two P input plots. There was a little bit less than a doubling of phosphorus, about 42% more in the surface horizons. This was about a 300 ppm increase, which corresponds to the decrease in the maxorption of phosphorus. So how much phosphorus could these soils potentially retain if they're hit with a high spike of phosphorus? In more relative terms, this means that there's about a 2 to 4% decrease in the maximum absorption potential of the amended soils, even after 11 years of phosphorus inputs. This is because these soils are a fairly strong phosphorus sink with a max P-sorption of over 3,100. To put this into some context, at the current application rates, it would take over a century to begin to approach phosphorus saturation, and that would be on the order of over 5 tons of elemental phosphorus per hectare. So the next question is, there is an increase in total soil phosphorus, great, but where is it being partitioned? Is it going into more labile fractions, or is it being fixed? And on this graph here, we have on the x-axis the Pmax sorption, which we saw is decreasing with more P inputs. And on the y-axis, we're looking at the occluded non-extractable, in other words, the fixed phosphorus that plants cannot get to. And it's inverse. So in other words, as we're adding phosphorus, the Pmax sorption is decreasing, but this is coming at a cost of much of that added phosphorus becoming fixed. About half of it, in fact, is becoming fixed. Looking now at the more extractable phosphorus fractions, on the x-axis we have the Hedley sequence of fractions ranging from resin, most labile, to HCl extractable, which is least labile. On the y-axis we have the total or the absolute ppm value. This is for the surface. This is for the 0 to 15 layer. So what we see is there's two main trends that come out when we look at the effects of 11 years of P additions, either as TSP or rock phosphate. First is that there are increases in inorganic P fractions with P inputs. Second is that these P inputs either do not affect or they decrease organic P fractions. Because there's more total phosphorus in the P amended plots, this corresponds to a proportionally lower amount of the organic phosphorus being inorganic pools. So in other words, a greater piece of the phosphorus pie for the unamended control is inorganic phosphorus, about 25%. And furthermore, these changes are due to decreases with P inputs in the NaOH extractable fraction. This is the more humified, the more stabilized organic matter phosphorus. We can group these fractions by supposed lability. And with this, we can look at the depth effect of P inputs. So on the right, we have the three depths. On the x-axis, we have these three groupings of labile phosphorus coming from those fractions. And on the y-axis, we're looking at the percent of total phosphorus. So this is now considering how P inputs over a decade affect partitioning of phosphorus lability. A few things come out. First is that the effect of P inputs decreases with depth. And within these two input types, there's not much difference between TSP versus rock phosphate. Perhaps a more prominent trend is that with depth across all plots, including the unfertilized control, there is a shift in P lability towards less labile fractions. So the next question that we had was, what does this mean for the farmer? What is this costing the farmer to add 50 kgs of elemental phosphorus, which is the recommended rate in this region, to their soil for 10 years? We crunch some numbers and we account for differences in phosphorus content and the cost of the input. And what we see is that the net increase in labile phosphorus over 11 years, that the cost of this net increase in labile P is not too different between TSP versus rock phosphate. Rock phosphate is about 8% cheaper in terms of increasing labile phosphorus. So the next step of this project was to consider how liming might affect pea fertility, especially in the unfertilized control. So to get at this, we performed incubations adding calcium carbonate at three different liming rates, including an unlimed control, and we let this go for 4 weeks under warm and wet conditions. We hypothesized that liming would increase pea fertility in two ways. First, it would increase inorganic phosphorus, labile P, by leading to desorption of fixed phosphorus. And second, it would increase cycling of phosphorus through organic pools, as the increase in pH with liming would be more amenable to biological cycling. And that this would be shown through indicators of microbial biomass phosphorus and soil phosphatase activities, enzymes implicated in cycling of organic phosphorus. What we saw was a little bit unexpected. So there was an unexpected drop in pH as a result of the incubation itself. In this graph here, we have the pH of four different samples. You see on the left, beginning with unincubated, that's the pH of the soils before they were incubated. L0 is no lime added, just incubated. And we can see that the drop in pH corresponds to an effect of the incubation on bumping down the pH. As a result, the liming did increase pH, but it was a matter of 1.5 steps back and 2 steps forward, so we weren't getting above the beginning pH. We're not quite sure why this happened. One reason might be is that the nitrogen present in these plots may have nitrified, leading to a drop in pH. That said, these results are somewhat difficult to interpret because of the sudden drop in pH. In fact, we're seeing opposite trends than what one would expect for lime additions. First, we see an increase in maximum phosphorus absorption. So in other words, with lime, these soils could hold on to more phosphorus. This should be decreasing. Second, we see a decrease in labile phosphorus pools. What might explain this is that a drop in pH would increase the number of binding sites through iron and aluminium oxides. So a drop in pH might lead to these two observations. One possibility is that labile phosphorus could have been sequestered away in organic pools, but there was no change in organic phosphorus content in this incubation, and microbial biomass phosphorus showed the same trend, decreasing with liming rate. We checked out the soil acid phosphatase activity, and there was no apparent trend among liming treatments there. So that said, I think we can come away with some points. One is that over the course of a decade, TSP and rock phosphate are equitable P inputs. They offer comparable increases both in net labile phosphorus increases and the economic cost of these increases to the farmer. But these increases in labile P are coming at a different cost, and that's that of P fixation. These soils are very strong phosphorus sinks, and for that reason, acid correction pH management should be considered along with phosphorus inputs to make these more efficient. So for this, we need to repeat this experiment, perhaps let it go for longer. And excitingly, or at least I think, this past month was the conclusion of the first year of adding a lime treatment and split plot design on these same long-term trials. So hopefully the field data will show some effect of liming on improving pea fertility. So any questions? So you're speaking of the graph between, there's an inverse relationship between occluded phosphorus and the PMAX absorption,
yeah.
Correct? That was more to show that over this decade, while you're decreasing the P saturation, you're increasing P saturation, the PMAX is going down, meaning that you can't hold as much phosphorus, that corresponds to an increase in fixed phosphorus. So the idea there was more that the decrease in P retention potential is coming at a cost of quenching those sites with phosphorus. Yeah. Was that answering your question? Okay. Sure.
We have more time for questions, so.
Yeah.
So you showed some economic back to envelope calculations about crunching peelability versus input cost. Is there any, so that's an operationally defined pool of labile phosphorus, but do you have any idea of how that reaction relates to an increase in plant response or total yield component?
Sure. So one thing to note is that for the most, the labile phosphorus increase that was mentioned there, that's summing together the resin extractable phosphorus and the bicarbonate extractable. So it's that sum together is going to be more than your Olson would be for your test soil phosphorus. If you look at the resin phosphorus alone, which is less extractive than Bray or Olson, we're seeing values of about 28 to 40 ppm, which is very high. The minimum for maize, I believe, in this region is 7 to 8 ppm for Bray or for Olson. So, to answer your question, these amended plots, though they can still hold on to more phosphorus, and only a small fraction of the P inputs are going into the most labile pools, they're well above the response for crop yield in terms of phosphorus.
So you wouldn't expect to see a response then, right?
No, would not expect it. We have yield data, but it varies seasonally due to rain. Since these are rain-fed systems, more of, so a larger driver of yield is rain in this system than the phosphorus deficiency. The changes in yield stopped after the fifth year of pea inputs, but there's no soil data on that.
Nathan?
Yeah, so it seemed like there wasn't a lot of difference between the triple superphosphate and the rock phosphate and the amount of phosphorus that was available. And in the end, you showed that there wasn't a lot of difference in price, and I guess I would have expected more of a price difference. I would have figured that rock phosphate was a lot cheaper than triple superphosphate for these producers.
Sure, yes. So rock phosphate is more or less half as much as TSP, which makes sense. It's half as much phosphate. And so the calculations that we crunched were taking into account phosphorus content and then price per the mass of the inputs. And since they have comparable increases in labile phosphorus, and the double of price corresponds to the doubling of P content for TSP versus rock P, the total final cost came out to be about the same. That makes sense. Yes, effectively. TSP is about 12% more expensive per unit of phosphorus input, but in terms of how that translates to labile phosphorus pools in the soil, they're equitable, and so the final numbers come out supporting rock phosphate as being about 8% cheaper. And that's for the 0 to 60 depth.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.